Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And by Open Account, a podcast that gets personal about making, losing, and living with money. Created by Umpqua Bank and hosted by Suchin Pak, download and subscribe to Open Account wherever you get your podcasts. And by Green Chef, a new food delivery service that makes cooking easy with consciously sourced healthy recipes and organic ingredients. Get 4 free meals with your first order when you go to greenchef.com/culture.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Calamities Ensue edition. It's Wednesday, July 13th, 2016. On today's show, The Night Of is a, it must be said, thrilling new HBO limited series. It stars Riz Ahmed as a young, college-age, second-generation Pakistani-American who finds himself in exactly the wrong place at exactly the wrong time. And then the Iranian filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami died last week. He's widely acknowledged as a modern master, one of the, you know, really true greats of world cinema. He's also, I had to confess, a blind spot of mine. We're assuming maybe also something of a blind spot for some of our listeners. We thought we'd rectify this in a little way by all watching one of his movies. Dana picked the 1990 film Close Up. Spoiler, it's a masterpiece. Finally, we discuss the gathering flap over Hollywood actresses and plastic surgery. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Julia, what slew of flimsy lies did you tell to get out of jury duty this week?
I just asked for a postponement, so I'm going to have to go do it again in 6 months.
Well, it's great to have you back.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for covering for me last week.
We may do without you. It took a team, but we did it. Did it take a team? Last week was a team, yeah, Dana?
Yeah, it was guest central.
Yeah. And of course, I'm joined by Dana Stevens, who's the film critic for Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Julia, before we dig in, surely we have business, yeah?
Yeah, several pieces of business. First of all, do not forget to buy tickets for our live show at The Mount, Edith Wharton's home in Lenox, Massachusetts. That will be on the evening of Thursday, August 4th, and we'd be delighted to see you there. You can buy those at Slate.com/live. Then...
Wait. Should I make a special offer here, which is that if you jokers come to this thing, I will meet you at 2 p.m. that day on Thursday and take you all on a hike, you guys included. The deal is you have to come too. I will take you on the best hike in the area that I live in, which is 10 minutes from the Mount, if that. And then we'll all head over to the show together.
I like it.
That sounds good. How long and arduous is this hike?
That's under 4 hours.
Aren't we going to be like cramming and like reading Edith Wharton? We can't leave it to the shows and like...
I'm revising my outfit for the show now. This is getting crazy.
Even better, there's no signal on the hike. But listen, here's
Steve's
the thing.
He's trying to sabotage the show.
He's going to lure us into a cave.
And they were never heard from again.
I happen to be familiar intimately with the amount of prep we actually do for these live shows, so I think a 4-hour hike is in order. But here's the thing. It's not 4. You can do it easily in under 2.5. And
there's, God.
I swear to God, there's the most amazing treat at the apex of the hike. I'm just telling you, I will do this, but we have to sell out the Mount show first.
Could it be like at 9 a.m. the next morning or like 10 a.m. that morning?
Deals.
You're making me nervous.
We can negotiate this.
All right. Plausible hikes. Hikes will plausibly be affixed to this event if enough of you buy tickets. That's as far as I'm willing to go. Nothing like doing a 4-hour hike in 2.5 hours to prepare you for a live event. Okay, second piece of business, Slate Plus. One of the benefits of Slate Plus this year is that you get to join a virtual book club with Laura Miller, designed to help stanch any holes in your literary education. And so all year long, she's partnered up with a couple of different Slate folks to read classics that they've never read before. So she read Thackeray with Willa Remus, and she read Willa Cather with Willa Paskin. And I'm up, and we are reading Barchester Towers by Trollope. So if you're a Slate Plus member, you can listen to our initial show where we talked about what to read, and then we will produce an episode where we discuss the book and what we thought of it later on this summer. Members of Slate Plus also get to listen to our bonus segments on this show. This week, we're going to talk about the horrible news last week in Baton Rouge, Minnesota, and Dallas, the way that it was viewed and covered online, and a provocative article that I suspect we may agree and disagree with about why we watch the news and how we watch traumatic news. So we'll discuss that in our Slate Plus segment. You can join at slate.com/culture plus. All right, Steve, what's next?
Thanks, Julia. All right, moving on. The Night Of tells the story of Nazir Khan, a young man arrested for a grisly murder. We are almost sure that he didn't commit, though along the way we do see piece by piece, bit by bit, his every careless decision. His nightmare night begins when he borrows his dad's taxi cab out in Jackson Heights, Queens, without permission, to get to a party that he wants to attend in Manhattan. He compounds this by picking up and partying with a mysterious and beautiful young woman. The whole thing adds up to a wrong man horror story to end all wrong man horror stories. This show is terrific. I cannot wait to talk about it. But first, let's listen to a clip.
Yo, guys, I'm off duty.
What?
I'm supposed to be off duty.
You are? Your light isn't on.
Yeah, I know. It's, see, I don't know where the light is because it's not my cab.
Are you going to make me get out?
Well, where do you want to go?
What do you mean?
Well, you got in my cab, so, like, where do you want me to take you?
The beach.
The beach?
Yeah, the beach.
We're in Manhattan, so I could do a river.
A river would be fine.
Well, Julia, I think it's fair to say that this
don't
this
do
been...
it. Don't let her get in the cab.
I know it is. I mean, if you have any issues with anxiety, you really need to pop an extra Klonopin before you
it
put
was
this thing on.
I mean, the first 50 minutes of this are the most anxious making.
Yeah. Yeah, hair-raising.
I have a question about that, actually, because, okay, I think we will all agree the first episode of this show, The Night Of, is all about the setup, right? And it seems to be moving very, very slowly at first. You seem to be seeing more details than you need to see of this young man's night out on the town. But, of course, all those details end up figuring in later for his alibi and, you know, evidence against him and other things that come out at trial about that night. But did you guys find it hard to maintain sympathy for this character over those 50 minutes in which he makes one terrible decision after another? The only thing that saves it for me is that he's played by a wonderful actor, Riz Ahmed, but I think there's such an over-determination of his stupidity in the first episode.
I didn't think so, Julia. I'd be curious to hear what you think. I didn't think so at all. There's a wonderful philosophical question, which is that if you add one grain of sand to another grain of sand and then keep adding a single grain of sand, when does it add up to a heap? And I think I kept thinking that as I watched this, that each one of these little decisions that he's made, none of them in and of itself indicates that a heap of trouble, you know, the size of the one that he ends up in, is going to accumulate. And yet it does. I thought it was incredibly effective. But what do you think?
Yeah, I didn't have the, like, don't be stupid, why are you doing that thing quite as much as I sometimes do in stories that have protagonists who get themselves into scrapes. Because I think the show does a really, really good job of sketching pretty quickly what kind of guy he is. You can see how responsible he usually is and how much he yearns for a bigger life. And, you know, there's a moment early on where you get a sense of what kind of person he is and what sort of respect he has for the authority of the police when he's lost and a cop pulls by. He's like a young man in a cab that's not his, and he asks them for directions. You know, he's not trying to avoid the law enforcement system.
Right. As one of the cops says at one point when he's taken in, the wonderful role played by Ben Schenkman, the cop says, who's this Bambi who's over here looking at me for the last 2 hours? And it seems to me like a big part of the setup of the first episode is what a Bambi, his character, actually is. And obviously he's going to be led into all, you know, a web of all kinds of, you know, corruption and so forth. I mean, I've only seen one episode beyond the first, but I can tell that things are going to get really dark in this show.
Yeah, yeah. And not to be heteronormative about it, but I mean, I have to say, watching this, like the allure of the woman that he picks up who inadvertently creates this, you know, hell for him, this kind of criminal, you know, hell for him is that's done, I think, very well, because that's not that is not a cliche. The, you know, cab driver in this instance, the ersatz cab driver picking up the beautiful young woman, you know, who within her person carries an amazing amount of sex and mystery. And I think the reason why it's carried off so beautifully is the episode. And I think many of the subsequent ones are written or co-written by Richard Price. He's the novelist of Clocker's fame, among many other like really, truly wonderful genre books. But also he of The Wire. I mean, Richard Price wrote quite a lot of The Wire. And I kept thinking, Dana, that this was the first TV I'd seen since The Wire went off the air where every bit of it was filled with keen observation, powers of observation and wit. I really thought it was to that quality in the writing, certainly.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, I'm not sure I would say it is the only thing that's as good as The Wire since The Wire, but I do think that basically the first 40-odd minutes of the show, and I think some of the reviews may have made this analogy, but it's sort of like a horror movie. Like, you're just like, oh, God, don't know. Don't go in there. Don't open that door. Don't go in the basement. I mean, there's no actual basement, but the whole thing is like it feels like that. Like, don't. This is going to go so bad for you. And then it turns into a bleak real politic cop show, you know, sort of a very sophisticated cop show with kind of the like jazzy astuteness of Richard Price and the kind of bureaucratic real politic, the drama of the boringness of the injustice of the American criminal justice system, which feels familiar from The Wire. And as soon as you get over that hump, you're like, I'm back in horrifying but comfortable television territory, and I'm looking forward to the rest of this ride.
But for the record, I wouldn't say that it's the only thing as good as The Wire since The Wire went off the air. It's just the only thing written in that particular style where, like, every detail, it's just the kind of detailed apprehension of bureaucratic, you know, like dull gray but deeply, deeply sinister bureaucratic reality that really defined, I think, each season of The Wire. It's really in this. Dana, it's also inspired by something else as well, which is the addictive true crime of the serial and Making a Murderer seem to have gone into conceiving and shaping the show too.
Oh, you mean you think that the serial was an actual influence on this show? Because
absolutely. I mean, I'm not the only one to say it. I mean, I'm not original in saying it. A lot of people have pointed out that, you know, a wrong young man, especially a wrong young man of the potentially wrong color and religion, you know, story is really inspired by Serial. And we should say that John Turturro stars as his defense attorney, so the role of the heroic defense attorney comes maybe partially, somewhat inspired by Making a Murderer. Maybe not. I don't know.
Well, I guess also like Adnan Syed, he doesn't have a real alibi, right? He doesn't deny that he was there and that he had all these connections to the woman and that there's all this physical circumstantial evidence against him. He just simply says, I know I didn't do it. Then there's the disturbing fact that at the time of the crime, he was not conscious. He had passed out. So I suppose that there could even be some doubt as to whether he himself knows whether he did it or not.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that the actor at the center of it, Riz Ahmed, is like a find. And Dana, you're familiar with his work, right?
Oh, yeah. I was so excited that, well, that was basically when you guys had me with this topic, you know, when we were sort of floating, oh, this new HBO show. All I had to hear was Riz Ahmed. You didn't have to get to the H of Ahmed before I was completely in. This actor, I feel like I've had my eye on him for so long, and he still looks so young. He looks like a baby now. And if anything, he looks more like a baby in this series than in the first thing I remember seeing him in, which was Four Lions in 2010. Remember that terrorist comedy?
I think we did. I didn't know he was in that.
He was one of the inept terrorists in that sort of controversial comedy about terrorism. And he was in another movie about terrorism called The Reluctant Fundamentalist that I reviewed that was pretty mediocre in every way, except that it had this stellar presence at the center. I think he's much better known in Britain than here. He's British Pakistani, and he, I think, was a rapper and kind of a successful DJ before this and has sort of been like a handsome guy about town in the British papers for some time. But I think he's kind of finally going to become a household name. And then most recently, he was in Nightcrawler, which I don't think we did talk about on this show, but I did review it. It was that Jake Gyllenhaal vehicle that was about the unethical journalist. I thought it was a piece of complete trash and a really absurd kind of view of journalism in the 21st century. But there was a wonderful character, and a minor character who was kind of a dumb stoner kid played by Riz Ahmed, and he was one of the saving graces of the movie. So I think this guy's been waiting to get this kind of role handed to him for a while.
I will say the one thing that nagged me about this show is the opening credits sequence. I strongly dislike, I have yet to look up and do the baseline reporting that would make this a smarter observation, but the opening credits sequence of this show, of last year's True Detective, and of Animal Kingdom, the show that you guys talked about last week, which I watched even though I wasn't able to come in and discuss it with you, all have the style of like really dark, super close-up, like little fragmentary shots of like people's bodies and, you know, but then like urban lightscapes and then like back to the close up and then like a map and then like a snake of car headlights and slow-mo and blurring and some kind of like dark grungy song. I'm like fucking sick of it. Stop opening your shows that way. Get a new team. I hate those opening credit sequences.
But what do you expect this theme to be, Julia? Like the night of jazz hands. I mean, it's a dark show.
I did keep hoping that the night of, that was my joke as I was watching the movie. I was like, maybe it's just the night of the, he like meets a nice girl from the other side of the tracks and they like have a fun date in his cab. It's a cab date show. I knew it wasn't that. I'm not saying it can't be dark. I'm saying find a new way to be dark. I think all three of those credit sequences to me seem derivative of and much worse than the True Blood opening credit sequence, which was the first that I can remember to do that kind of like dark, heavily like blacked out, like cross-cutting close-ups of weird things. But the song in that was like so twangy and jaunty that it all crystallized into something that felt very fresh and cool. And these like maundering, just like stop it with the maundering credit sequences. Don't like them. Get something different. That's my one critique.
This is kind of tragic because the surprise at the top of the hike I want to take everyone on is the maundering credit
sequence. God damn it, Steve. Forget it. I'm never going into the woods with you.
All right. Well. That's that then. All right. Well, it won't soothe your nerves, but it's masterful. It's called The Night Of. It's on HBO. Check it out. And let us know what you think of it at facebook.com/culturefest.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The Iranian film director Abbas Kiarostami died within the last couple of weeks. He was the critically acclaimed director of something like, I think, 40 films, shorts and documentaries and features. Most famously, the Coker trilogy and Taste of Cherry, which was awarded the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. He also is very well known for the 1990 film, widely regarded as a masterpiece, Close Up, and Dana suggested that we watch it as a way of talking about his work. Let me read a little bit from Dana's really beautiful memorial to Kiarostami that was up on Slate last week. She says, let's start with the can rolling down the hill in Close Up, a 1990 masterpiece by Iranian director Abbas Kiarostami. It would be crass to argue on the very day after this irreplaceable artist's disappearance about which of his movies was the greatest. Different fans will have differing allegiances. None of them will be wrong, but it would be hard not to argue that Close Up, a film based on real events and reenacted in part by those who lived through them, is among the most original and important movies made near the turn of the 21st century. Dana, the obvious place to start is with you. I agree with your assessment completely. Close Up is a remarkable movie. I mean, it's so unusual. I wasn't even sure exactly what I had seen when I was done with it. I really wanted to take 24 hours to think about it before I went into Wikipedia to determine exactly what I saw. For those who haven't seen the movie, describe why it might be somewhat disorienting. Utterly entertaining. I don't want to put anyone off this movie. It's one of the best movies I've ever seen. But why is it? Describe a little bit about its unusual mixture of documentary and fictional elements.
All right, I will. And it may be that I also have not completely prized apart, even after many viewings, the different layers of fiction and documentary and reenactment of this movie. But essentially, the inspiration for this movie was a real event in which a young man in Tehran impersonated, passed himself off as the director Mohsen Makhmalbaf, who in Iran, like Kiarostami, is extremely well-known, kind of household name director. So this young man is riding on a bus next to an older woman, and she notices that he's reading a script, a screenplay for this movie, The Cyclist, that was written and directed by Mohsen Makhmalbaf. And in this sort of combination of feeling flattered and wanting to impress her, somehow he ends up giving her this screenplay and passing himself off as the director. And from there, it sort of balloons into this sort of case of fraud, right? That was a real thing that actually happened in Tehran. Kiarostami heard that it was happening, started reading about it and following it in the papers, and started to make the documentary while it was happening. But that said, it's difficult to tell when you're watching close up how much of what's happening is a reenactment of something that previously happened, how much is actually a scripted sort of documentary about the making of the movie about this man itself. Kiarostami's voice is heard off screen, and there's a sense that he's guiding and shaping events in some way. He asks permission to film the trial, and here I'm not quite sure whether, because the quality of the film changes a bit there, whether that is an actual filmed trial or a reenactment of a film trial. And I know this is sounding all tangled and crazy, but when you're watching the movie, it feels more like a rose that has many layers of petals, and you're kind of getting to the center, and they all sort of nestle together in a very satisfying way. This is going to be a hard movie to talk about without spoiling anything. So I think we're going to be talking about formal issues a lot, because if you start getting into the subject matter, the movie becomes less fun to see.
Right. Now, it should be said that there's no huge spoiler here. You know from the beginning that he's not this film director.
Right. Well, in fact, and that's a huge part of the way the story is told, right? It's chopped up to a whole different bunch of different perspectives, different points of view. There are actions that start at the beginning of the movie that we don't see the completion of until near the end of the movie. And so it's very intricately edited in that way.
Mm-hmm. Julia, had you seen this movie before? And what do you make of it?
I had not seen this movie before, and I'm very glad that I have seen it. Although I will say the drama is entirely psychological. Like the movie, that shot of the can rolling, with the exception of like one or two other shots, is the only kinetic thing that happens in the whole movie. Like a tray is moved, and at one point there are a couple car rides. But like other than that, it is just people sitting still and talking in living rooms or in courtrooms and occasionally in a prison. And so the drama unfolds in this very quiet manner, with people describing what they know about each other and how they came to slipperily interpret and impersonate each other's lives. But as you see those people sitting still and talking, you're cutting across like various class distinctions in Tehran that are probably less readable to us in America 26 years later, but are still certainly perceptible. And then also, because you have the title card that says playing themselves, you have this total mindfuck of a like, wait, what?
That's a very important thing that I forgot to say up front. Thank you, Julia. Yes, Hossein Sabzian, who's the man at the center of the movie, the guy who passes himself off as Makhmalbaf and is arrested and goes to trial, and whose story Kiarostami follows, plays himself. So that in itself is quite incredible.
But they all play themselves.
And the family that he defrauded play themselves
as well.
And
the journalist who followed the story plays himself.
Is there anybody who's cast in a role? Is there anybody in the reenactment who refused? I would imagine there's a making of documentary about this, which I haven't seen actually. It's on the Blu-ray disc as an extra. And I would suspect that there has to be some combination, some people who, for whatever reason, legal or personal, didn't want to go back and revisit this moment and play themselves.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about his mom. I mean, there's a couple other characters in the movie, but I'm certain, but I've definitely read that the journalist, the defrauded family, or were they defrauded? Or were they in fact given the performance of their lives? And Sabzian himself were all played by those real people. So you're watching this thing that seems actually dramatic, but also like quiet and slightly inert in terms of like the stillness of the frames. I mean, often the camera just kind of sits and watches people talk and do quiet things. But you've seen this title card and you're like, wait, what are these people doing? How did this happen? Like, this really happened? And then these people are reenacting it. And then how is this poor guy who got caught up in this impersonate? Now they're all being asked to impersonate themselves on screen, all for the love of cinema. I mean, it's just, it's a movie that is a lot of its activity takes place in your own mind, wondering what the fuck is going on, I would say. And and satisfyingly so, although I would not recommend watching it. I would recommend, like, I think it's actually playing at Film Forum now, maybe in honor of Kiarostami's death. And I would recommend, like, going to see it with a group of people in a theater, or, like, I would not recommend watching it alone in the morning on a, like, TV in a room that's too bright where you can barely make out the subtitles, as I did. I would say I had a suboptimal viewing experience.
Well, this is the thing I was going to say about Kiarostami in general, to step back for a second from close-up itself. There's a wonderful quote that came up a lot in the week after his death, about taking naps in films, and that he had been accused of having slow movies by some critic, and that he said he enjoyed movies that allowed you to take a little nap, and that he thought that it was that a movie should be a place for sort of restful reflection or contemplation, and that's a lot of what I think feel like his movies are about. That rolling can that, you know, you read the detail of from my obituary, Steve, is a moment that happens for no reason in close up. It's essentially almost a little tag at the beginning. It's in the first 10 minutes of the movie that tells you pay attention because you don't know what's going to be important.
Right. But it also makes you wonder, is that something that just happened, or is it, you know, that there happened to be a can there and he happened to be filming, or is he imbuing it with an enormous amount of symbolism? And in fact, the movie is about that ambivalence and that ambiguity, the inability to really know which one Kiarostami is doing at any given moment. I really don't want to undersell this movie, and I don't want to make it sound like a postmodern puzzle piece, because it's a great, I think, truly a great film, and it's not boring, and it's not up its own yin-yang about issues of who knows what when.
It's also short. It moves along quite swiftly for a movie that has so little action.
Yeah, if you're going to nap, make it a quick one. The movie, I think, is a work of genius for showing both the humanism of a work of art and the power of the humanism of a work of art within the context of the film, by the way. I mean, the film is itself a deeply humane work of art, but it's about how works of art are construed as being deeply humane, but how they also take place within an economy of prestige. And these two things don't always complement one another, and they've come to an enormous conflict in this poor, suffering man who sees a kind of universal humanity in the works of a film director who he loves. His own life is a nightmare, semi-nightmare of poverty and unemployment and obligations that he can't fulfill. And he sees this enormously powerful expression of the human condition in these films, and he so identifies it with it, he creates this kind of pathetic fallacy, and he makes himself in his own head, not in a psychotic way, but really in a sympathetic way, into the author of those films. Which, if you think about it, when you really connect with a work of art, there is a part of you that feels as though you're co-authoring it, and something vulnerable in this guy breaks down, and he kind of He believes, but not really believes, that he has kind of made these movies and wants to inhabit that person. And that's humane. But then there's a second level, which he confesses to. He's asked by the judge, and again, this isn't a spoiler, but he's asked by the judge, why did you persist in this illusion if it wasn't criminal, right? I mean, because that's the question at the heart of the trial, is were you doing this in order to take their money and eventually steal from them? And he says, no, I persisted in it because they gave me their attention and respect. And so this movie takes place at this, you know, excruciating crossroads of this man's social invisibility, which he feels is alleviated by this work of art. But what does that give him if he then doesn't pretend to have made it? Because he returns to his own life as someone who's socially invisible. And to really alleviate it, what he needs is the prestige of the great artist. And I think that's where the really profound sadness and wisdom of the movie derives from, because that theme is persisted in up until the very last shot of the movie. It's really just one of the best movies I've ever seen. It's amazing. I can't encourage people enough to see it if they haven't.
Oh, Steve, I knew you would swoon for this one. I also just want to mention this. I can't even describe in any way what the ending is like, so as not to spoil it. But Kiarostami is great at endings. He is always great at endings. He does not have a credit sequence or the moments before a credit sequence that aren't incredible. And often the way in which his endings are incredible have to do with framing and with sort of moving back and making you see the moviness of the movie, sort of existing around the story. And the ending of this movie does that really, really beautifully. The whole movie has this austerity. As Julia said, it's not very action-oriented. There's no non-diegetic music until the very end. And then it feels so earned, right? The moment that this lyricism kicks in feels so right.
Yeah. The movie is called Close Up. Dana, before we exit the segment, what other movies by Kiarostami do you recommend?
You know, I only chose this one for us to see. I mean, this is maybe my favorite of all of his movies, but I mainly chose it for us to see because it was the most accessible and convenient. You could find it on more streaming sites than most places. But if you can dig them up, you mentioned some at the beginning that are great. There's this set of three movies that are referred to as the Cocaire trilogy after the village that they take place in and around. But they're not really related to each other, and Kiarostami didn't intend them as a trilogy, and all three of them are great. The first is called Where is the Friend's Home? It's about a child. A child is the protagonist, as was often the case in this first wave of Iranian cinema, that, you know, you could tell stories about children that you couldn't necessarily tell about adults and get in some allegories that you couldn't in a story about older people. But Where is the Friend's Home is a fantastic movie. The second one, which is one of the hardest to find for some reason, is maybe my favorite, is called Life and Nothing More, or sometimes the title is rendered as Life and Nothing But. That's a beautiful, beautiful movie. And then the last one, which I think is a little more accessible because it was after Kiarostami started to be known abroad, is called Through the Olive Trees. So all three of those I would recommend also as a way to kick off your Kiarostami fest.
All right, fantastic. Please, please, please watch these movies and report back to us. And let's discuss at facebook.com/culturefest or via email, whatever you want to do. But incredible film, highly recommended, Close Up by Abbas Kiarostami. Okay, moving on. All right, now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about our other sponsor, Julia Turner. What do you have?
The Slate Culture Gabfest is also brought to you by Umpqua Bank. How much money do you make? How big is your savings account? These are some of the most personal and maybe uncomfortable questions that someone can ask you. But where does that discomfort come from? On Open Account, a podcast created by Umpqua Bank, host Suchin Pak and her guests get open and honest about making, losing, and living with money. You'll hear an NBA star talk about his first professional paycheck, a Daily Show producer recall his parents' penny pinching, and a husband and wife duo discuss the role that marriage plays in managing their small businesses. And that's just the first three episodes. These conversations wind up being about way more than dollars. They're about culture, power, class, and the complex emotions that drive our financial decisions. Open Account is available wherever you get your podcast. So download, subscribe, and get a little more comfortable with your money.
All right. Well, about a couple of weeks ago, the Variety critic Owen Gleiberman wrote a column titled Renee Zellweger, If She No Longer Looks Like Herself, Has She Become a Different Actress? The piece was supposed to be, I think was supposed to be a sensitive meditation on plastic surgery and the state of Hollywood actresses' faces relative to shifting standards of beauty. Let me quote from it a little bit. Gleiberman wrote, I was caught off guard the other day when I saw the trailer for Bridget Jones' Baby. The movie star Renee Zellweger already had her did she or didn't she moment back in 2014. I'd followed the round the world scrutinizing of her image and went along with it. But this was different. Watching the trailer, I didn't stare at the actress and think, she doesn't look like Renee Zellweger. I thought, she doesn't look like Bridget Jones. Oddly, that made it matter more. Celebrities, like everyone else, have the right to look however they want, but the characters they play become part of us. I suddenly felt like something had been taken away. He goes on to describe her old look with pillowy cheeks and quizzically pursed lips. Rose McGowan, the actress, among other people, were deeply, deeply offended by this column, responded with unreserved contempt and vituperation. How did you feel about it?
Poor Owen Gleiberman. I feel like I have sympathy for him. And I don't think I think he's muddling through a set of complicated feelings in this piece. And there are parts of it that are more deftly expressed and with which I'm more sympathetic, and parts of it that seem a little bit naive and blinkered. But I think that Rose McGowan's response is like absurd and not particularly apropos.
Well, we should say she basically fired off a kind of op-ed, right? An open letter to Variety,
sure,
saying that essentially she had dropped out of the industry because of the kind of sexism and what she saw as this, you know, brutal bullying white male behavior in Owen's piece. And I guess I'm kind of with Julia on this one. This reminds me, there was some other time. Oh, when we were talking about Misandry with Dan Coyes, remember, Julia, where you and I, the two women in the room, were on the other side of the sexism question.
Yeah.
I can't work up that much outrage about this reflection on plastic surgery, which it seems, I don't know. I mean, could a female critic have written that? Would a female critic have written that? It does seem like the question of an actor's face, which is their instrument, right? A close-up of in a movie is essentially sort of like the actor playing their instrument. For someone to take that instrument and alter it dramatically does change the way that you relate to that famous face. And I think that's what he's trying to interrogate somewhat clumsily and, as you say, maybe a little bit naively. But I don't think with malice, and I didn't come away feeling disgusted by the existence of
that
column. Yeah,
it just seemed like a bad sign of the state of discourse that he was like so roundly excoriated for this piece, which is clumsy. And I will attempt to lay out the few points that he makes and where I think some of the logic holes are. But I stipulate that I do so without decrying his like worth as a human being or ability to speak about anything in the film industry ever. So there's one part in which he says it's confusing to talk about actors' faces because you can never quite tell if they've had plastic surgery or not, even if you can totally tell. Like you, it's as a journalist or as a critic, you're not supposed to talk about things that you don't definitively know, and we never definitively know, even though your eyes can tell you a lot about what has happened to someone's face. And that can create confusing situations as a viewer relating to the work of an actor. So that's point one. That seems fine. There's point two, which is that somehow whatever has happened to Renee Zellweger's face is a particular betrayal because of the kind of beauty that she represented on screen, the kind of characters that she's most powerfully played, and what that represents. And this is the part that I think is the weakest and wrongest of his points. But basically, he argues that like she's not beautiful like a normal beautiful actress. She's approachably beautiful. She looked a little bit weird with her squint and her pursed mouth and her broad puffy cheeks, and that she wasn't beautiful in the way that Julia Roberts is beautiful. But like, that's just crazy. I mean, Jezebel had a very smart piece pointing out that the kind of approachable beauty, the flawed beauty, the beauty with the birthmark, the beauty with the various qualities that make them seem approachable, and like you might know them and they might sit next to you on a bus or get into the back of your taxi or whatever. It's like almost all great actresses have had some quality like that. And even Julia Roberts, to name the one that he holds up now, is this like, you know, I mean, Julia Roberts is not Grace Kelly, right? She's like, everyone talked about her like gangly cultishness and her like freakishly huge mouth and her long sloping nose. Like she's like a specific looking person. She's not a like a fembot. And so anyway, that whole notion that somehow Renee Zellweger represented a particular archetype of ordinary beauty, and thus it is like and played a couple roles both in Jerry Maguire and in Bridget Jones of like ordinary womanhood on screen represented, and so it was a particular betrayal of the audience of her oeuvre to do weird things to her face, just seemed like wrong. And that was the thing that offended me most about the piece, is just like, oh, I think you're like totally wrong about how female beauty operates on screen, and you seem sort of naive about it, and that makes you maybe like not the person to be trying to guide us through a nuanced and sophisticated set of questions here. On the other hand, I really resist the Rose McGowan notion. I mean, I don't deny, I'm sure it sucks to be an actress in Hollywood in many ways. I'm sure that you deal with sexism rampant and subtle all the time. But I do think, I mean, I think we've talked about this, where also I took the unfeminist position about actresses wearing pretty clothes on red carpets. Like, I don't know. I feel like that's part of the publicity apparatus for the movie. I feel like, A, your instrument sort of is your face and body, and critics should be allowed to talk a little bit about your face and body, not in a leering, what a hottie way, but in a like, how do your features help you do the work that you do? Like, that's an interesting thing to read about when you read about film criticism. And I just don't, I don't know. I think like Alan Gleiberman was wrong, but I don't think he was like out of line.
And in his way, in his clumsy way, I think he was trying to make what he would frame as a feminist argument, in the sense that he was saying like women should stop having feeling like they have to do things to their faces to be beautiful.
I thought that was where the rubber started to hit the road a little bit, interestingly, which is he's kind of making a semi-empirical claim, which is that the standards for Hollywood beauty have actually changed since the first Bridget Jones and since Renee Zellweger broke in Jerry Maguire, and that there has been a standardization in the direction of superficial perfection that places an enormous pressure on actresses who've got at least a somewhat non-traditional beauty to amend it, you know, via plastic surgery. I just wonder if that's true. I mean, it just seems to me at the end of the day, have audience quote unquote tastes in this regard really shifted? Like, people have always wanted, both from men and women on the screen, a kind of ordinary ideal, like a streak of ordinariness or relatability, to use the current term of bullshit art, but, you know, to go with also a degree of unattainable perfection. And it's that combination, that sort of totally lightning in a bottle combination, that makes someone into a, you know, more than just like a TV star or a soap opera star or a model or whatever, into a movie star. Has that really changed? I don't know about that. But there, I will say that as a white male in danger of misspeaking every time he opens his mouth, rightfully so, by the way, in my estimation. But anyway, like, it is a little hard to talk about, you're talking about an artist, as you guys pointed out, whose instrument is their own physical person. They're very often, they've gone through a rigorous Darwinian selection process that really only allows extraordinary looking and being people to emerge at the top. You know, how is a male critic supposed to write about female beauty on screen without sounding like a hideous lecher, you know, and card-carrying member of the patriarch? I don't think it's that easy. And on top of which, to begin with, and it's gotten that much harder, but then on top of which, I think plastic surgery is an interesting one. I mean, you know, I think we're all caught in the vice, right? Like, we don't want average people to be on screen. We live among and are ourselves average people. There is an element of just comely, you know, comeliness as escapism that goes into making movies that we want. At the same time, we don't want to, like, reductively objectify human beings who are trying to, you know, treat their acting as an art in some way. And it's like, I just think it's a really tough needle to thread. And I guess we all agree on this, that the Rose McGowan response, which is really, really like unbridled contemptuous vitriol, is pretty, at the end of the day, is kind of counterproductive. On the other hand, she speaks from experience. You know, she's been objectified in this way and was revolted by it, and more power to her.
I mean, she and some other people who wrote and posted on this is drawing this very hard line of just like, I don't want any male critic assessing the appearance of any female performer on screen. And that seems like that boxes the critic up in a strange way.
I just think that's a crazy position. But I also feel for Rose McGowan, who frankly I think is being exploited here. She like wrote a hot-headed screed, which is newsworthy because she's a like, you know, famous actress who has like already tangled publicly with the like Hollywood industrial complex. You know, like the she did not actually write the counterpoint op-ed to Lieberman.
She just vented.
And it's like not a piece you would actually publish if she weren't the person that she were. Anyway, I feel like she's being used, frankly, for like clicks in this instance rather than actually being helped to make an interesting and persuasive argument. But back to the point you observed, Steve, I mean, I do think that the another irony that I think it was the Jezebel piece about this pointed out is that Gleiberman seems to have watched the trailer for the forthcoming Bridget Jones movie and be lamenting that Zellweger's face does not look the same as it did, you know, 20 odd years ago or whenever the first movie came out, which cuts a couple ways, right? So if her face has changed from plastic surgery, it's not the same in a way that doesn't feel natural. But of course, part of why actresses get plastic surgery is because they're pressured to constantly look the same mm-hmm. as they did 20 years ago in a way that's completely artificial. And that's sort of how you end up there. So having the, like, whatever you want to say about an actress's face as her instrument, having the presence of mind to acknowledge that a person's face might change over 20 years is actually mm-hmm. part of the problem rather than part of the like sympathetic and slightly paternalistic condescending solution mm-hmm. that I think rankled people. And I also think another point in that same piece that I loved is like Bridget Jones is totally the kind of woman that would have had possibly bad plastic surgery. So like this doesn't seem like maybe the right instance. Also, certainly before the movie even comes out. I mean, you know, to get to the place where I comment on Renee Zellweger's face, because let's just get to that part of the conversation. Like, I actually think her face looks like mostly pretty normal in the trailer, especially compared to the weird photo that was much scrutinized a couple years ago. Yeah. And again, weird photo. I mean, like, there's photos of me where I look like a freakish alien. Like, it's hard to know from that past flap what the evolution of her instrument has been. But like, I don't actually find the way she looks in the trailer to be particularly distracting at all.
Well, Dana, this raises an interesting question, right? Which is, where do we draw our sort of puritanical line? Is it between no plastic surgery and plastic surgery, or is it between good plastic surgery and bad plastic surgery? Dana, I know you've had a lot of work done. What?
Yeah, what I'm actually 73. You guys do not know that about me.
What was your internal dialogue before you got, you know, do you have any kind of fixed principled position on plastic surgery? Is it case by case?
I think I do less and less, I would say. I mean, I was thinking...
As you get older and older, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, in part. I mean, I guess I feel less judgy about it, maybe because the culture is less judgy about it, maybe because, you know, I'm closer to needing it. But I see that there's a feminist side to both sides of the argument, right? I mean, I feel like the old school kind of first wave feminist or second wave or whatever, Gloria Steinem era feminist position would probably be plastic surgery bad because not natural, right? It works against the natural effect of gravity on your face and, you know, just let yourself grow old. You'll look nice that way, right? That would be one feminist position. But of course, the position that Rose McGowan and plenty of other responders to this are taking that I think also has its own legitimacy is stop judging me for what I do to my face, especially if you're part of the society that puts such emphasis on appearance and on particularly female appearance and female youth, you know, that standard can't coexist with judging someone for trying to look better according to those very standards. That the whole thing is so psycho, in other words, that you can't find the right feminist stance within it, really.
Right. Mm. I'm curious to hear you talk about how you describe the physicality of actors and what you think about there and how that's evolved.
Yeah, I don't know. I was wondering when we were doing the prep for this segment whether if I went back with a fine-tooth comb, which I have no desire to do, and look at all my reviews, have I talked about an actress's appearance and possible surgery in that way or an actor's? I can't remember, but I wouldn't put it past me. I mean, I wouldn't hold myself above that and say it's somehow beneath me to talk about an actor's appearance, especially if you're doing a sort of like this Owen Gleiberman piece, which is not a review, but is sort of a reflection on a larger trend in movies. I mean, I think we also haven't talked at all about the fact that there are plenty of men who have screwed up their faces too, with Mickey Rourke being the most salient example. But, you know, there's obviously lots of surgery being done to keep other famous faces looking the way mm-hmm. they always did.
Right. But there was no code of silence surrounding Mickey Rourke, as I recall, right? People spoke quite openly about how kind of peculiar he looked relative to his younger self. I guess there are a lot of borderline cases. I mean, people, I don't think, remember quite how unusual Sylvester Stallone's face was back in the early to mid-70s when he debuted Rocky. You know, how Rocky went from being this kind of, you know, beefcake with a crooked smile to this paragon of male perfection, which took, you know, a lot of weightlifting at a bare minimum and I think some scalpel work. That probably wasn't discussed.
Yeah, I mean, men get off the hook. I mean, this is where Rose McGowan's rage, if inarticulate, is potent and I'm sure justified in some respects, is like, we just talk so much more about women's bodies and faces than we do about men's. It's still true. The fact that the culture seems to be moving more in the direction of men being just as neurotic and obsessed and judged as women doesn't seem great, even if it seems more equitable. But I'm dying to know, would either of you guys ever get plastic surgery? And are you plumped with fillers already? Dana does have an amazing complexion. It's really quite astonishing.
Would I ever do surgery? No. I don't think I could do that. It feels too much. If nothing else, it just feels like a waste of money. You know, it feels like a huge investment in your own vanity and that somehow God would get you back for it soon yeah. afterward. But I do feel way less judgmental about it. And also, it might depend on, you know, if you were fixing some small specific thing that was bothering you, if it wasn't sort of like, I want to look younger and I want my whole face to look like it did 20 years ago, but sort of, I don't know, I guess my mother had her ears sewn down because they stuck out. You know, that's a form of plastic surgery I might do if my ears bothered me. I mean, something that was sort of like fixing the fringes, I guess I could see. But something that's an actual attempt to just turn back time and re-youthen your whole face feels like Faustian bargain. That's what I would say.
How about you, Steve?
I would pay any amount of money to look like Samuel Beckett. as I grew older. So I think
there's somebody who looked better the older he got, right? He got more and more.
It's true. I would pay good money to get cragged like that guy.
You got to find Beckett's Cragman in Paris.
I need Beckett's Cragman. Get me Beckett's Cragman on the phone. Also, I need like a thick, lusty quiff of gray hair, you know, that just is popping right up off of your skull until the day you fucking die. I don't know what kind of a procedure you have to have the coal black burning, you know, tempestuous eyes of a genius, but
I think it's just those contacts they wear in vampire movies, Steve.
So I guess the answer is yes.
It's interesting. I would love a world where plastic surgery was all geared towards the specific kind of aging you want. Like, what if you want to be elegant crow's feet aging, but actually your bags below the eyes aging, and you're like, fuck, can you just like take the skin folds of my bags and turn them into elegant crow's feet? Yeah.
All right. Well, the essay was by Owen Gleiberman. It's titled Renee Zellweger, If She No Longer Looks Like Herself, Has She Become a Different Actress? That has kind of a wonderful If a Tree Falls metaphysics to it, I guess. But anyway, check out the essay and let us know what you think about this and the subject of plastic surgery, facebook.com/culturefest. All right. Now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about our other sponsor. Julia, what do you have there?
The Slate Culture Gabfest is also brought to you by Green Chef. Green Chef's USDA certified organic meal kits make it easy to cook healthy and feel great about where your food comes from. They deliver everything you need to cook amazing dinners right to your door. Their meals come pre-chopped and pre-measured, so you can get dinner on the table in just 30 minutes. Plus, they offer a nice amount of choice in what kind of meal you like to eat, so you can go paleo or vegetarian or gluten-free, or now even vegan is a new option. There's no shopping, no planning, and no commitment. You can switch between menus, skip weeks, or cancel whenever you want. Right now, Green Chef has a special offer for our listeners. Enjoy 4 free meals when you sign up at greenchef.com/culture. That's greenchef.com/culture.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Well, I know, Steve, that you get a lot of flack from listeners for your local endorsements whenever you talk about this tiny little ice cream place in Hudson or this quaint little pizza joint in Vermont, and people get upset that only a few of them can access that place. But this week, when I tell the backstory, I think you'll see why I'm going to give a local endorsement, but not for my own location, for a location in Los Angeles where I spent last week. I went to LA on a research trip, which was great in many ways, and it was wonderful to see the stuff that I got to see in the Academy archives. But it was strange in the sense that it was a weird week to be alone in a high-rise hotel room while the world was falling apart last week, while basically America felt like it was burning around us. And at a certain moment, I just realized I need food and I need company. I have to get out of here. So I got out of my high-rise hotel and started walking down Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills, which at night is a dead zone, basically. It's just all closed businesses. And there was this little place called Afghani Kebab House that I had passed a few days before thinking, oh, I should check that place out one night, completely not fitting in with the territory at all, a little brown hut of a restaurant called Afghani Kebab House. And so I went to check it out. And as it turned out, it was this restaurant's opening night. It was their grand opening, but they were about to close because I had spent so long anxiously refreshing the news and staring at screens that I had missed the hours the restaurant was open. So they seemed to be cleaning up. You know, I went in and chatted with the owner and said, oh, could you maybe just make me something to go? Can I just get some food to go? And he said, oh, no, come sit down. We're not completely closed. And they basically reopened the restaurant for me, let me sit there alone for an hour having an absolutely delicious meal, which, by the way, I never saw a menu. I just said, make me a plate of delicious Afghan food. And he did. And we chatted a little bit. We didn't even talk about the events of the night, but there was just this sense of communion and company, and that there was someone taking care of me, almost like going to someone's house and having them cook you a meal. And so after this delicious Afghani spread, I went in and said, what do I owe you? And the man would not let me pay for the meal. He said, The cash register's closed. It's on us. You can help us out by telling other people that our restaurant is here and that you liked it. And so this is the largest audience that I can find to say that if only for that story and how soulful and wonderful that man was and how much better I felt about humanity after leaving his restaurant, but also because he has delicious, reasonably priced food, you should go to Afghani Kebab House at 8560 Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills, California. You would not expect this restaurant to be in this place. ice. It's basically a little dive, but it is absolutely wonderful and it's worth the trip.
That's an amazing, heartwarming story. But if you didn't see a menu, how do you know it's reasonably priced, Dana? Didn't see a menu. He didn't charge you. It could be like 12 gold doubloons per kebab.
Julia, have you heard of a little thing called Yelp?
All right, fair enough.
And as it happens, I think the very first review that this has on Yelp since I was there on opening night is me telling this story. So if you want to go hear a very moved me coming straight back from Afghani Kebab House and typing up the story of my dinner, you can go on Yelp and read the reviews.
I did not know that Dana had a Yelp profile. That's like the biggest revelation of this whole story.
I think I created one for this purpose. I don't know if I've ever reviewed a restaurant
before. You got to go review some other stuff. People don't trust reviews from people who've only ever reviewed one place. I want to know about your local dry cleaner, your local Botox purveyor. That's amazing.
Yeah, how do you get free shit elsewhere? I want to know that. All right, that's a wonderful story. That is really sweet. Julia, what do you got?
I have a recommendation that's also local and sparked by a fortuitous coincidence, which is that I saw the Broadway version of The Crucible last week, and Bill Camp is in it. He plays the Reverend Hale, so the same character actor who played Detective Box on The Night Of has a very different and also quite well done role in this performance. And it's a twofold recommendation. If you are going to be in New York and are interested in the theater, I definitely think this production is worth checking out. It stars Ben Whishaw, much beloved of this program, possibly edging out Jesse Eisenberg as the premier actor in the hearts of Dana and Julia.
I don't know, but Riz Ahmed is pulling up pretty fast from the rear there.
I don't know. I'm not sure. Not sure how long Whishaw can hold position. But anyway, he's great and he's very good in this. And Saoirse Ronan is in it and Tavi Givenson. It's a great cast. And the production is interesting and striking. So if you're inclined, I certainly think it's worth checking out. But also, and this is going to be one of the patented Julia Turner endorsements where Julia Turner discovers a classic that everyone else has already been aware of for a long time. But weirdly, I grew up in New England and never read The Crucible. I mean, I grew up within, you know, however many miles of Salem, but just was never taught The Crucible in school and never saw production of it and never sought it out to read it later. It's just a really good play. Arthur Miller knew how to write a play. What do you know? Revelations by awesome. Julia.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, well, I'm kind of on your same, you know, revelatory wavelength with mine. But I'll begin by saying, Dana, I think you agree with me that any excuse to mention the name Clive James on this program is to be welcomed. The other day, Clive James, who, it should be said, has been diagnosed with serious illness for years now, and he himself has become quite funny about reports of his own death being greatly exaggerated.
And has also become more prolific since his diagnosis, right?
Yes, exactly. He's kind of everywhere and enjoying himself in this wonderful kind of last act kind of way. I mean, it's really an amazing celebration of life. He's a wonderful writer. He has been for decades. He went to Glastonbury, which is just awesome, the thought of octogenarian Clive James.
Glastonbury's like British Coachella or something.
Exactly, Brit Coachella. I mean, the thought of him, the kind of, you know, penetrating, you know, wit of his generation, you know, in his 80s, I believe in his 80s at this thing, is just too great. But he saw the band Churches, and he talks about the lead singer, Lauren Mayberry, as follows. He says, all around the vast stage, Lauren hopped and floated in a skein of her delicious melodies, a tangle of white muslin being agitated in an invisible washing machine. Could any angel be more wildly delicate? To put it another way, could any angel be more wildly delicate while wearing work boots? Dana, this is so doubly, triply pleasurable because not only do you get to listen to Clive James, overhear Clive James falling madly in love with this little waif on the stage. It brought me back to the night that Clive James fell madly in love with you when you were out to dinner with him. Because you too are a tangle of white muslin being added to an invisible washing machine, at least when you're out to dinner and had three glasses of wine with Clive James. But thirdly, it put me to mind of Churches, which is spelled with a V in order to make it more SEO friendly, which I just think is so fucking millennial. But I know everybody knows this band. It is like endorsing The Crucible or the TV show Cheers. But I went back and listened to them after reading this. I'd kind of listened to them, liked them, and then not thought that much of it and moved on. But I gave it another chance. And I love that album, The Bones of What You Believe. And I really love the track that went big, We Sing. think is just a great song. And it has the additional virtue of being a song that I can put on, crank up, and my 13-year-old daughter doesn't reduce me to a tiny little nub with a spiteful look. She kind of liked it. So anyway, I like that song, and people should check it out. Thank you so much, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Anna Hepperman. Our intern is Lizzie Fison. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lickteig. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, the Culture Gap Fest. We are part of the Panoply Network. So if you like us, check out the entire roster. It's at itunes.com/panoply. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Julie Turner and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you soon.